Happy Wednesday.
Good morning, everybody.
This is December 9th, 2020, and this is episode 134 of Transmission.
So I've been thinking for a while about like episode 150, right? These sort of milestone marker numbers. It's coming up. It's on the horizon.
Just around the bend. Hopefully we'll have a civilization still.
Yeah,
we will if we can manage this dialogue business well.
That's right. if we don't find the limit of the dialogue.
Just to introduce ourselves, I'm Mark Van Stunwyck. I'm the director for the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolper. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. And actually, before we get rolling, I want to say a word or two about Missouri stories.
in honor of
Kathleen, who hasn't said good morning yet. So I don't know if she's on today, but hey, Connie. So those of you that have been listening off and on have maybe caught some of Kathleen's great Missouri stories. And, you know, there is something about Missouri that inspires these just wild stories, and I wouldn't have believed it so much if I hadn't gone there. So Trey already used to work with Micah's from Missouri, and so we went down there. He was going down to bury his father's ashes, and you know, we were only there for like 36 hours, and the number of these stories that we heard were just remarkable. In fact, it was so impressive that when we came back, we did this little like David Letterman top 10 thing. You know, and people tell these stories like with no trace of sort of humor or irony or like they're that outrageous. It's just like, yeah, this is what we do. And so the number one story, I won't tell all 10, we don't have time, but the number one. You know, and again, we were sitting around the dinner table with these folks that Trey had grown up with, and they all went to the same church. And so they started talking about this church matriarch. And, you know, she taught Sunday school for 100 years and, you know, did all the church things and all this. And they were like, yeah, she never had kids. She never had a family. And, you know, one of the women around the table said, well, yeah, the reason that she never had kids is because she was afraid they would come out black. And I was just like, like looking around the table, like wondering, you know, what's going on. And he was like, yeah, they, you know, she had heard that there were maybe some black people in her family tree and she didn't want her baby to come out black. So she never had kids. I'm like, that was just the end of the story, and then everybody moved on. So
I don't know what to do with that.
I know, exactly.
Oh my God.
So anyway, Missouri is full of these things.
Strange anecdotes.
Yeah, very strange anecdotes. Yeah. So
where do we go from there, Dan?
So where do we go from there? So the limits of dialogue, and I appreciate our friends chiming on here with dialogue jokes. But the kind of dialogue we're talking about is actually not what we're doing here, which is dialoguing among friends and fairly like-minded folks. But a lot of what we've been hearing recently since the election, particular, but even before then, you know, how do non-Trumpers talk to Trumpers? I mean, just to sort of frame it very crassly. And, you know, we have to dialogue, we have to engage. And So
been the entire posture of the Biden pre being sworn in period, right? He's just kind of focusing on the shift on dialogue and reaching across the aisle, that usual sort of stuff.
So we thought we'd talk about that and whether or not that makes any sense and is a worthwhile expenditure of time. And, you know, I guess just to put it right out there on the table, I think it's not. I think it's a waste of time and actually not really worth the few moments of life that I have left on Earth to spend them doing that. So that's what we're going to talk about.
But Dan, the biggest problem in our society today is polarization. And if you don't reach across the aisle, it'll tear this nation apart.
Right. That's the logic. And so to me, one of the directions to go with this is to actually look at sort of what is required for basic social cohesion. And, you know, Mark, you come from a rural area. I don't. I come from a small town out west called Los Angeles.
You've dwelt among us, though, Dan.
Well, right. But for about half my life, I've lived in rural areas and, you know, mostly surrounded by people who are much more politically conservative than I in a whole host of ways. And it's never been a problem. That's never really been an issue. Because what really is required for a cohesive society are things that are just kind of very basic agreements about how you function, right? So, like, you have to all agree that you stop at a red light. Like, that's important. you know, if it gets to the point where you're not agreeing about that, then that's something you need to have a dialogue about. But who you're voting for in the presidential election is actually not required for a functioning society. I've done business with very conservative folks. We've seen those people at our clinic. We buy groceries from them. We have sold groceries to them when we had a farm. It's fine, right? It's fine. One of the things to ask ourselves is when we're then engaging in deeper, more meaningful community with people above and beyond those basic functions of society, do you really need to have dialogue with people that have views that, for whatever reason, you find really repugnant?
It seems like part of the logic of this, there's two ways I hear this sort of emphasis on dialogue. One is this assumption we're all in this together and we have to be civil, and therefore we have to have a base minimum of conversation. And usually that implies that any disputes we have are really differences of opinion and we need to hold them gently. I don't like that way of thinking about things because it just sweeps all the oppression underneath the rug when that happens. The other one is kind of one that I'm more sympathetic to, which is kind of the evangelistic reason for dialogue, which is, hey, there's a lot of these fuckers. They're going to destroy our nation if we let them have free reign. So we need to somehow reach out to them and convert them at least more in our direction. I'm more sympathetic to that. But even then, having done a lot of evangelism in my life, I know that there's this sort of catch-22 that happens, right? Evangelism, for conversion to really happen, requires a lot of vulnerability. People are not likely to have vulnerability with the person who disagrees with them. And so it creates this bind, like you have to deceive your way into their good graces in order to convert them. And if it's the moment people kind of smell that out, they're going to shut down. So we have to recognize that there's downsides to evangelism. One of them is the deceitfulness of it. The other one is it usually requires some sort of trauma being exposed for someone to shift in large ways in their political or religious viewpoints. So, yeah.
We've got some good comments coming in.
Just going back to some, this is still only anecdotal evidence. We have to do a large study to know if this is true, what Dan is saying. But my friend Megan is from Kansas City, Missouri, and the stories she tells are just completely bananas. Yeah. You could probably get a grant for that, study that, Dan.
That would be fun.
Kathleen, who's our friend from down there, says, I am so grateful for this group. I'm leaving pastoral ministry because of a church that refuses to wear masks. This has been a painful choice. Yep. That's heavy. I'm sorry to hear that, but yeah, it seems like seems good that you're honoring your boundaries in such a bad situation.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and to me, that's a great example. Maria's comment next, you know, is another example of this, is that, right. I mean, we realize the sort of wastefulness of this kind of dialogue when we are in more intimate situations that are either kind of life or death situations, or that just, you know, impinge upon our being to a great extent. And we recognize, like, this isn't going anywhere. This is a waste of time. This is harmful for me. You know, this could kill me. This makes me miserable all the time. I'm living with this person. We just recognize that this is not a place to expend energy in a healthy way.
No. Which gets to Maria's comment, divorce because dialogue was insufficient.
Yeah.
And that connects, like, Gregory's comment here. I find it offensive and disrespectful that more value and emphasis is placed on people who have shown you the middle finger than on those who consistently show up and carry you to electoral victories. I mean, this relationship of, you know, the classic examples, the way that the Democratic Party treats white, moderate, mostly rural folks versus how it treats the Black community. Like, they take the Black community for granted in order to suck or favor with the you know, the white folks. And this like people that stay in horribly damaging marriages, any sort of dynamic like this is, you know, we had this whole episode on codependency, like where we somehow think it's our responsibility to suffer through that in order that they might change. And so we hold out hope and take all the stuff upon ourselves, the responsibility, and then this only enables them to keep doing the crap they're doing. I think that's this, what this emphasis on dialogue often ultimately does in our political discourse.
Yep. Yeah, and I want to come back to that, but let's go through some more of these comments.
Sure. Joanna writes, good morning. Thanks for hashing this out a bit. It's helpful to know how to respond when progressive folks make these claims, which they haven't all interrogated.
At all interrogated. Yep. Yeah.
CK writes, I think it starts with language and how it's taught in school. I have 2 school-age children and notice how teachers and students interact, who listens and pays attention.
Right. Right. And so to me, one of the things that I've been thinking about this and also looking backwards, you know, beyond the Trump world, is to flip this around and to say, okay, so within that world, is this idea of dialogue important? And the reality is that it's not. Right. So one great example in the church world is the creation of the 7 fundamentals, you know, the fundamentalist movement around the early part of the 20th century. And, you know, that was largely crafted and constructed by a number of, you know, white male, tall steeple church pastors, and then their various adjudicatory bodies that were feeling very threatened by science and by the Enlightenment and by Darwin and theory of evolution. And they basically just said, this is the right answer. Like, here's the line in the sand. You can't question these 7 fundamentals. If you do, you can't come to our church. You're going to go to hell. You know, they didn't propose this as a dialogue. They didn't say, okay, well, you know, we'll take 3 out of 7, or we'll take 4 out of 7. How about 5 out of 2, you know, 5 and 2. You know, could we create our list and then you can have your list? Thanks, Mark. Yeah, counting. It's hard just, today.
I had to count my fingers, yeah.
You know, they didn't say that. They were just like, this is it. Mm-hmm. There's no conversation. So, you know, and I think about family systems theory. I think about, you know, roles of dominance and submission in society. And, you know, I think about my own experience of being bullied as a kid. You know, the jocks that were beating me up, like, they didn't want dialogue. They were just like, we're going to push you over. Like, that's it, you know? And so I think that there seems to be something about the people that are gravitating towards this position mm-hmm. that, you know, I think if you looked at the role in the family systems and social systems, you would see that, you know, the people who are taking the non-dominant roles kind of have this idea of, oh yeah, let's just get approval. Let's just talk. The other people are like, no, we don't want to talk to you. And I think that's an important thing to recognize.
This is my experience, but I didn't shift from being a fundamentalist libertarian to whatever the hell it is that I am now because of dialogue, right? What happened was that I felt cognitive dissonance because of experiences. Certain things, like, I'm sure moving to the city was a part of it. I started experiencing things outside of the norm to me. And I realized that lesbian person doesn't worship Satan. Like, I just started noticing these things. And so I raised questions. And then the moment in which dialogue actually became meaningful was when I, in my vulnerability, sought it out. They didn't come and give it to me. They weren't trying to work on me. That would have actually worked. That would have backfired. It would have solidified my position, which is what often dialogue that's unsolicited does. Right. But even then, so to me, that I think the posture of being available, being in relationship at some level with people who have differing views, who are not going to change, mm-hmm. has merit. But you don't invest a lot in that. If they know what you're about, they'll seek you out if they start having mm-hmm. questions. That's usually how it works. And that we have anything stepping beyond that is this sort of like needy enabling posture. Getting back to the comments, Gregory writes, evangelism under a white evangelical paradigm is inherently manipulative and coercive. Amen.
Yeah, amen. It's not actually about dialogue.
this is one of those statements that I could imagine people like, well, but this is one of the statements that's just across the board true. White evangelical paradigm is toxic. Marcia writes, I recently read an article that suggested we can most successfully dialogue if we are discussing local issues on which we might agree.
Yeah, sometimes. But I think that, you know, Mark, what you're saying is what's key to this. And this is one of the, you know, whether it's psychological, philosophical, you know, flaws in this idea of dialogue is that actually dialogue doesn't work until you're actually interested in dialogue. I mean, it sounds simple, but it seems, you know, and in teaching, we talk about the teachable moment, right? That you can be lecturing to a classroom full of people.
Yes.
And if they're not open to learning anything, they're not going to learn anything. Right. Yes. And there's an open moment where suddenly they're like, oh, I actually want to listen to this. Right. Yes. And so it's kind of like dialogue is already there before you can have dialogue. That's the weird paradox of this.
No, and connecting it to the educational side of things, I think is important because to me, this is all part of the package deal of how we idolize education as something that cures social problems. Right. Information can, but like just the sort of didactic approach where we, like, from the pulpit every Sunday we give a message or we like do advertising that's like information like about say no to drugs. Those sorts of things don't really have any effect unless someone already is looking for it. And this shows it's true in education. It's why sermons don't really matter as much as we think they do. When the vulnerability is the prerequisite, And if you offer the information without the vulnerability, it's kind of wasted. Marsh's comment about successful dialogue being at the local level, though, I think also shows another addiction we have, which is to always start our political imaginations from the top down, right? So the fact we're talking about Trumpers versus not Trumpers shows that we have a very nationalist way of thinking about politics. Local levels, you know, you're right. You're more likely to find people that are also conservatives and liberals who both don't want to put that dam in or whatever it is. And so it's important
although
to focus
I think
on local politics.
Yeah. Although certainly having been very involved in discussions about police in the city of Minneapolis recently, I could say that there's a lot of times
there's limits.
It doesn't work either.
For sure. Especially around hot
topics. Just get on next door and try to have some dialogue.
I mean, especially around issues that are like so heavily politicized as policing. People putting a stop sign in a certain intersection is a totally different way of thinking about things. And so people don't fall into the same habits of debate. Ed writes, and the progressive community, they hate us. Or no. Radical community.
Yeah. I wonder what that's referring to. I have to say a little bit more about that. Not really sure what you're talking about right now.
It may have fit precisely in a comment that we said. So please say more. Philip writes, I have been freed from the last vestiges of the efficacy of evangelism as nothing more than thinly veiled colonialism. Thanks be to God, to George Tinker and his book, Missionary Conquest. Yeah, I mean, to me, the only evangelism that's ever valid is one from the relatively powerless to the relatively powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Christian evangelism can so co-opted by a dominant way of thinking in relationship to the world that it's become intrinsically tainted. So I agree. Carol writes, we all come to Earth to learn best wishes.
Okay. It's a cool idea.
Ceres writes, I think a lot of people who won't entertain the truth about the limits of dialogue often have internalized the culture war paradigm, fawning / appeasing to it, maintaining it rather than just seeing it as a way of accountability.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thanks for that, Ceres. Connie writes, my sister and I disagree politically and religiously, but have decided to put this aside for family unity. We want to be friends.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is what I kind of another example of what I was getting at about basic social cohesion is that if you just decide like, right, we want to live in the same town together, we want to be friends, we need to do business with each other, you know, I buy farm equipment from you, you buy seeds from me or whatever, society can function. And this is one of the things that I do think that we're seeing in a very dangerous way at this point is that when you get to the point that you're not willing to agree on those basic things, then that becomes a real problem, right? Or when society is engaged in activity like slavery, like genocide, that is so unbelievably toxic to so many people and is so evil, that's when society cannot function anymore, right? If you can't agree to stop at red lights, that would be the end of driving, right? Which would probably be the end of our society. So it's important to see that there are these different levels of social interaction and things that we actually do need to dialogue and agree about and things that we don't.
Well, and let's say that you're in a town like, let's make it a little bit more stark, like some sort of sundown community or someplace where racism is institutionalized. And so the town is not safe unless you're white. To me, when you have that sort of political tension where you can't just all be able to live together without consequence, the idea that somehow you have to reach out across the aisle and have meetings and sit down meetings with the Klansmen it sounds heroic because we hear these stories about courageous black men building relationships with Klansmen. And I think that's beautiful, but it also fools us into thinking that's the most expedient and powerful way we can engage this stuff. And so we replace real politics for some sort of vague commitment to dialogue. And that actually keeps us from doing the business of real politics, which is gathering and exercising powers to restrain violence and evil. Becca writes, capital P politics, Dem versus Republican, is likely not a helpful conversation. But I think that what is helpful is learning how to engage across party lines to address specific local issues. Again, the local emphasis. This kind of grassroots organizing can help to build relationships and collaboration. If we can figure out how to do more grassroots organizing, I hope it trickles up the scales.
Yeah. And again, it can. And we encounter similar limits. But yeah, I mean, sometimes those basic common issues we can work on together.
I mean, that's the insight of a lot of folks who are saying progressives need to spend more energy in rural white organizing. And I think there's truth to that, because there is this anti-corporatism, anti-authoritarianism in rural areas that could find common cause with indigenous people kind of struggling against water contamination. Like, so that's a classic example in Minnesota, and it's limited, but there are fruits to it. So seeing calling out division and hate as a means of accountability. Thanks for clarifying. Catherine writes, I have a similar path to Mark and did find that some of the people who confronted me with dialogue during the Vote No campaign had a huge impact on my thinking. That said, it was people who knew me, so there was some degree of trust in the sense that I might be willing to consider my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's right. If you have some sort of vulnerability in a relationship with someone, they're going to be more likely to hear you out. Just approaching people who don't really have an investment in you with ideas isn't going to cause good ideas to win the day. David writes, we need to change hearts and minds of Trumpers. Seems to all end up enabling, prolonging, and participating in toxic mindsets, behaviors, and systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing that it does is that it wastes energy on building what I and my community think are a powerful, positive alternative. And so again, I'm always looking back to the Christian contemplative movement and other contemplative movements for role models. And, you know, the Benedictine movement, you know, these people who had no power, no money, no nothing, they didn't get together and say, hey, we're going to form this community so that we can dialogue with the Roman Senate about oppression in the Roman Empire. Like, they didn't do that. They just said, we know there's oppression in the Roman Empire, but we also know that God is calling us to live in a different way. And what we're going to do is we're going to expend all our energy forming this tiny little community, figuring out a different way to live. If that changes some people's minds by example, that's great. If that, you know, somehow changes the Roman Empire through example over time, that's great. But our energy needs to be vested in doing the powerful good things that we think are important. And so I think that we really miss the fact that, and this is the codependent thing, that it bleeds off a tremendous amount of energy engaging in dialogue with people in situations that don't want to have that.
Catherine writes, specifically it was dialogue with queer people. And by impact, I mean, now I'm a bisexual leftist. I think, you know, I look back at people that I knew around me who were more radical or leftist or something than me. And so when I was ready, vulnerable, I started talking and it expanded things. But yeah, Gus writes, on the other hand, I think it's worth noting the way that the left had dialogued its way right into extreme sectarianism. Green anarchist versus Maoist, Trotskyist versus Leninist. The left has a nasty habit of talking our way into division. I mean, we should have an episode about divisions amongst the left, because I think there's some crap reasons for that and some that are just kind of like logical consequences of how people organize around particular things. It's like at some level, and part of me like instinctively trusts some random Republican more than a Marxist Leninist because of like sort of, you know what I mean? Like, oh, you're a tenpenny. And clarifying that the people who hate radicals and progressives, the Democrats, or at least the Democratic Party establishment.
Yeah.
I totally think they'd rather have Trump than someone like Eugene Debs be president. for sure. So I think they do hate radical people more than they'd rather dialogue with the right than like actually dialogue even with the further left. Becker writes, you just need to find issues that people don't have a script for. I think that's astute. And people have to think for themselves to solve problems. We have too many scripts.
Yes.
I think that's
very true.
Very insightful and a good reminder that part of the resistance comes from like this banality of evil idea that we regurgitate cliches. We're not even doing the thinking. So talking to people, again, the classic example here in Minnesota is around water issues, although that's become more of the dominant script kind of conversation. Jeremy writes, Gus, isn't this true of every group? We try to define ourselves through differentiation, which ultimately leads to us defining boundaries that define.
Yeah, that's often the case. And that's what happens. You know, that's the basic human ego formation is that we start. We want to tend towards tribalism. And that as that solidifies, that actually becomes more and more problematic.
And also, we need to recognize that some people didn't decide to differentiate themselves. They were differentiated against. So right. A lot of stuff with people who are experience oppression due to sexual identity or expression. Like they weren't like, I'm going to start the queer community. They're like, right. Hey, they're all beating the shit out of us. Let's band together. That's where queerness came from. Identifier. Gregory writes, a teachable spirit is the fertile soil in which the seed of growth can take root and flourish. When we become more curious about the world around us, then convinced of the absoluteness of our positions, we can grow.
Amen.
I want to highlight that word curiosity. I've had conversations with folks like, that's a good indicator. If someone's not curious about you, don't spend a lot of words with them. I've been astonished. Like, some people are surprised. Like, I'm an author. I've written books about anarchism, religion, and I've written children's literature, right? And I'm this kind of weird creature, yet hardly anyone related to me ever asked me a damn question about my life at all. You'd think I would be curious to them, but I'm not.
Yeah. No, I mean, most people have very limited curiosity. I mean, I notice that all the time. Very few people ask questions about other people. There's very little curiosity. All right.
So he's right. Even giving basic need doesn't create liberatory dialogue. Facing loss and desire does, period. There's no other way.
Yeah. We were actually just talking about having an episode on that Simone Weil-ish episode.
Joanna writes, and then what is the next step if you successfully dialogue someone into enlightenment? I mean, it seems like that's where people's imaginations end. Like the work is done because people think the correct thing. Oh, yeah. And there's no moral or prophetic imagination about a responsibility to transform systems of injustice. Right. I think that's another astute observation. Like the way we think about dialogue often implies a changing of position as though that's the goal. And so we end up having performative people. White people in particular were afflicted with this need to perform in order to show things rather than seeking transformation.
Yeah, when the going gets tough, white people have book clubs.
That's right. Like this is why changing someone's position on a piece of paper without any deeper transformation is shitty, because like at the end of the day, the liberal white person can still just be like the dad from Get Out. Like if they have to choose between their security or oppressing that black person, they're like, I guess I'm going to oppress that black person now. So I'm going to roll it back. Maria writes, dialogue makes us feel like we are working on the problem without actually changing, without living into our own values. It sure can, for sure.
Yeah.
Connie writes, our brother, on the other hand, says you agree with me or you are stupid. There's no place for dialogue. I have experienced that.
Right.
Gus writes, Jeremy, maybe, but it seems like we allow the definition off to prevent us from working together in meaningful ways that we'd all agree on. Like we trade real movement for self-identification fine-tuning. Great. These are great comments, everyone. Gregory writes, it's my car and I can drive it down the street as fast as I want to. That's the adolescent illogic of folks refusing to wear masks. I agree, yeah. But it's been astonishing how important this is to people. We could talk all about that too. CK writes, would you say you can't speak truth to power? It seems like when you have institutions like white Christianity, white government, there can be no dialogue to create meaningful change.
Well, no, you can speak truth to power, but the question is, what is your expectation of what that's going to get you? And that's where, you know, I think some of these great comments and what we're talking about in terms of that there's a whole sphere of activity way beyond dialogue, right? To action, to organizing, to power, to creating alternative systems. I mean, speaking is one small step. and so, yeah, you can speak truth to power, but just don't have the expectation that power is going to agree with you and have a nice little sit down chat. Because that ain't happening.
Power is not usually given up because it's faced with the truth. It's because it feels threatened. Every once in a while, individuals can surprise you. That's why we have these stories about Zacchaeus and the rich young ruler. Individuals can change their place within the system, but the system won't change unless it feels threatened. That's kind of, anyways.
All right, let's roll through these last comments.
Series writes, we need to focus on building alternative non-siloed culture and social gardens and connect and solidarity other similar gardens intentionally, internationally, and locally. Just using the energy to convince death cult members is not productive. That's right. We should be putting our dialogue elsewhere.
Social gardens. I like that. Where Tyler, the robot birds can play.
No, they're not welcome. Tyler writes, the fact that the Democratic establishment doesn't even want to have dialogue with the progressive left goes to show that our current two-party system is essentially one party, the corporate party. This is a failure to the working class, and I believe why things are so broken.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Sirius writes, all we are only doing when putting the energy to convince cult members is investing in the principality and power even more, ultimately funding their war. Sirius continues, we don't need to keep putting the culture war and genocide that our imperialist machine started. Adam writes, this can be the final word from Adam. You can speak truth at power.
Yes. Yeah, wonderful. All right. Well, I'm so glad we did this episode. What awesome comments and reflections. It's a beautiful thing.
So much good stuff in there.
So much goodness.
Yep.
All right. Great seeing everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. And have a good day. Expend your energy well.
Amen.